Kirk and Scott, I got to ask you guys a question. What on earth has happened to America? The last primary, I believe it was Wisconsin, you had a man who is an absolute scumbag of a liar. I mean, this man doesn't have an honest bone in his entire body. And he overwhelmingly wins the Republican primary. That'd be Lion Ted. And the communist trounces the Democratic candidate in the Democratic primary. Where in the hell has America gone?
I can't figure on the Cruz thing, but I'm beginning to discover. I heard a guy talking the other day about the 40% of all the student loans are in default.
Mm. And of course, with Sanders, he's blaming the loans not on the person who took out the loan, but on the banks that mm-hmm. which is really the government that gave the loans.
Mm-hmm.
And with a guy like Sanders in a communist system, there is no consequence, you know, to each according to their need. I need a house. I need a car. I need the latest cell phone. I need the deluxe TV package. I need. Mm-hmm. And from each according to their ability.
It's even worse than that.
Doesn't work.
It's even worse than that. It's not I need. It's you have, so I should have.
Oh,
if you have it, you know.
It's my fault that you don't have.
Apparently, because you're not paying your fair share, so that somehow it's
yeah, okay.
Even though I know what you pay is far more than what I pay.
Yeah, by the way, I don't pay my fair share. In fact, the most productive Americans pay on average about 10 times their fair share. You know, if we're having a fair share, you would pay what you use.
That would
and the people that are paying by far the most use by far the least.
Well, y'all think about what Jerry Brown said, the governor of California. He raised mm-hmm. minimum wage to $15.
Right, and he also raised the tax on the most productive Californians, which mm-hmm. sent the most productive Californians out of the state.
Be equal, and I'm going, who said they have to be equal? Why did I work hard to carve out my little niche, and now I beg your pardon?
Yeah, you know, why is is being equal of merit? You know, Yahweh never talks about equality. He talks about liberty. He talks about truth. He talks about productivity. He talks about empowerment and enlightenment and enrichment. But he never speaks about, you know, what I've got this plan, you're all going to be equal.
Never.
Never. It's preposterous to think that equality ought to be the goal. With, by the way, the people that are advocating equality are the people who don't think of themselves as part of those they are equalizing.
Absolutely not. They're the elite.
Correct.
Why would you want to be equal? Why wouldn't you want to be something more, something better?
How could you be stupid enough? And by the way, the handwriting's on the wall for America, because it is Bernie Sanders is getting somewhere in the range of 80%+ of the young, recently indoctrinated/educated vote. How could you be so stupid that you would think that communism is a viable alternative? I mean, hasn't anybody looked at what happened to China when they became communist? 40 million people died in the first decade, and that it wasn't until they embraced free enterprise economically that the country began to prosper, and that when Russia went from a fascist system to a communist system, over 35 million people lost their lives, and that everyone became equally impoverished, having no freedoms, no rights, no nothing, their lives totally and completely controlled. And it was only when they shook off the manacles of communism did the people have some prosperity, some hope. I mean, you have to be absolutely, utterly ignorant and irrational to think that that is the right way to go. It's I'm just absolutely speechless that we have a country filled with people who would support a communist.
Mm-hmm.
And I am equally astounded that on the other side you would have people support a religious zealot who is completely and totally dishonest. And Ted Cruz. I don't even want to be associated with a nation like that. I mean, it's hideously disgusting. I am really glad that Yahweh has called us away from all these things. I had a friend that called me this morning and said, you know, I've been exposed to what you have written now for almost 15 years. And he said, you know, the yada yada experience for him had been about a decade, a little more than that. And he says, during these past few weeks, it's finally gotten to the place where I've just embraced it all. I think it's the clarity of observations for our time, which is just so right in your face as to what God accepts and what he rejects, what he hates and what he loves. He says, I finally realize all five of the conditions for the covenant, there's not a burden in the group. They're all benefits for me. And so if the requirements are benefits and the benefits are benefits, they're out of this world, why wouldn't everybody want to embrace the covenant?
You'd think.
And he says, so, you know, I've gone from wondering why only one in a million accepts the terms and conditions of the covenant, considering the fact they're all benefits, to wondering how in the world one in a million finds this, with as much as is working against us in our society, with the corruption of religion. Yeah, and he says, that's now the question I'm asking. He says, I finally understood why you spend and why Yahweh spends an equal amount of time exposing and condemning religion and politics and militarism, as he does, and presenting the value of his covenant relationship.
Because it's smothering.
It's smothering. It's devastating. It's a deadly plague, and it is a wonder that even one in a million find it. You know, and I think that the guys, that if you go from the time of the last of the prophets, which would be Malachi, Malachi, to very close to our time, Yahweh is saying, and he says it repeatedly through the prophet Yeshaya, which covers that whole swath of time, says, I looked, and I looked. I wanted to find somebody with whom I could relate, with whom I could communicate. I couldn't find anyone.
Tragic.
Couldn't find us all. It is rather astounding. I am having fun, by the way, and in the current chapter. I'm in the second chapter of now of Yeshaya. And Yahweh in that chapter is telling us exactly when and exactly where he's going to build his house.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? It ain't going to be built by man.
No. That's interesting.
Right? And it isn't going
to
be
to build their own.
Right, and it's not going to be put it on that what now is a disastrously polluted Temple Mount.
Yeah, the contaminated, yeah.
Not going to go there either. I mean, the stuff that's there is going to be gone. But he says that he is going to preserve Zion. And that he also says that Zion is not an independent mountain. You know, this idea that if you look at the map of Jerusalem right now, you'll see Mount Zion is the westernmost mountain. It's the ridge that you would come up from Tel Aviv up to the kind of the plateau that is Jerusalem. And it's called the Western Hill. It's called the Western Hill because the traitor back in the Roman conquest days that turned a Roman historian from religious traitor. He assumed that because that Western Hill is fairly prominent, that must have been the citadel that became the city of David. Well, the problem with that is that that isn't the location. And they know it's not the location because the city of Dode, David, has been found. And guess where it is?
Mount Moriah.
Mount Moriah. It's the Mount Moriah has, there are three, well, they found it on Mount Moriah. I mean, it's extraordinarily well developed there. I mean, I've been in many of the fortifications and the, you can see the walls and structures and, oh no, it's all there, including the terraces that Yah refers to. And what you find is that, when Dode came to the Yabusi, the Jebusites there, and the Jebusites taunted him, saying that the blind and the lame are going to keep you from entering. And blind and lame is really those who are ignorant, irrational, and unwilling to act, which means speaking of religious and politicized people. And Dode, of course, turned it around, and he says, so it's it shall be an idiom from this point on, the blind and the lame shall not enter the house. And it's true. It's blind and lame. If you're ignorant and irrational, if you are unwilling to act, you are not coming into Yahweh's home. So it has him conquering the fortifications of the stronghold, if you will. And the Hebrew word for stronghold is ridgeline, an elevated area that has a natural a protective capability because it's a raised area. And if you look at the Jerusalem, there are three valleys. And these three valleys create three ridgelines. One of the ridgelines, the easternmost, is Olives. That's where Yosha departed. That's where Yosha returned. Now, you know why he departed and returned from Olives?
Symbolic of the set of our spirit.
Absolutely. He left as a spiritual being. He's going to return as a spiritual being. Olives represents the spirit. Now, you know why the Temple Mount is on Moriah?
Well, it's the place where Abraham first offered his
That's correct.
Shack.
Yeah, it means to revere Yah. It's the whole purpose of the covenant.
Revere Yah, yeah.
Right. So you've got Abraham and Yishak meeting Yahweh there, along with Yosha, represented by the Lamb,
mm-hmm.
On the summit of Mount Moriah. Moriah. Mor means to revere, and then it's Yah.
Revere Yah.
Okay. So we know that that has occurred. The summit of Moriah is very well known. In fact, if you look at a Google map, because Yahweh and Yahshua said, I'm going to preserve it, there's nothing there. Best building site in the entire city of Jerusalem. Right in the center. You can't find a better place. And guess what? There's nothing there. There's nothing there to this moment. You look at the escarpment that is the Golgotha, where you can clearly see the skull in that cliff. And and that cliff is directly below, I mean, immediately below that cliff on the place. In fact, it's the summit is directly above where the Ark of the Covenant is, where Yosha's, the receptacle for Yosha's mm-hmm. upright pole was placed, exactly where Ron Wyatt found it. It's not, you know, I've always described it as the Jerusalem bus station. You stand in the back parking lot of the Jerusalem bus station. You can look up in the encampment, and that is true, but it's on the left, far left side of that area. Mm-hmm. And in the far left side of it, if you look up on the left side of it, which is where the exactly where he found Jeremiah's grotto, that's where the summit is. And there's nothing there. Now, let me tell you something else. That summit, a man's stride is a meter long.
Right.
Would you like to guess what the elevation above mean sea level is of the summit of Mount Moriah?
Well, I unfortunately have read this thing, so I don't want to steal your thunder, but yeah, I know exactly.
It's 777 meters.
Yeah, wow.
Would you like to know how far the summit is from the Temple Mount?
Seven paces or
700 steps. 700 steps. That's where it is. And so, what Zion represents, it's not another mountain. It most certainly isn't the Western Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Zion is the three elements that comprise Moriah. The city of Dode, the city of David, which is at the lower part of the ridgeline. Then you know, you have the terraces off to the left of that, and it says so it's between the terraces all around, including the area of, from the terraces up to the house. The house is the Temple Mount. That's where the cornerstone of the temple was built. It's about 40 meters above the city of Dode.
Interesting number there.
Interesting number there. By the way, you want to speak some interesting numbers? Every number revolving Dode speaks specifically of Yosha. Dode began his reign as king when he was 30 years old. You know, when Yosha began his public mission?
30 years old.
30 years old. You know how long Dode reigned in Jerusalem? Conclude 33 years. You know when how old Yosha was when he concluded his mission?
33
years old. And Dode overall reign as king, because he also reigned out of Hebron, was for 40 years. That's how long Yosha was tested before he began his ministry.
Wow, did not know those.
Yeah, all
put that together before. No.
Yeah, all tied into this. But what Zion represents is signposts along the way. What are the signposts? We get to camp out with God, city of David. Yeah. Who is God's most favorite son? Dode.
Mm-hmm.
They camped out together. They had their houses right next to each other. Not only the same neighborhood. I mean, they were right next to each other. We get to camp out together. You know, and one of the things that's kind of interesting, you know, we get to enter Yahweh's home.
Yes.
I think in the seventh dimension, to the extent that we have homes, and I think we do, we're not going to, you know, if you look at the example of Dode and Yahweh, their houses were in the same neighborhood within a, you know, you play golf within a driver of one another.
Mm-hmm.
But Dode had his own mansion. Yahweh had his. They had an open door policy. If you go into and out of each one, but you know, it's kind of like if I have a choice. And, you know, I'm here in a city now where my son and daughter-in-law live and my little granddaughter who's coming over this evening. And if I have the choice, you know, we help our son buy that house. I could live in one of the bedrooms of that house. Or I could have my own house and they could come over and visit and I could visit them.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I like better.
I like the second.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the way I think that the Dode, Yahweh things, the two houses are right there together.
Yeah.
I think that's
we like to feel a little individuality.
Right.
In that place.
Now, what Yahshua tells us, what Yahweh tells us through Yahshua, is that upon his return, he's going to establish, he is going to design, he's going to build, he is going to erect his home on the highest summit of his mountain. And he speaks of it among his mountains, but on the highest summit of his mountain. Well, that's the part that he already told us earlier. He says, this is Zion. Zion is the sign that I'm going to leave along the way. And he tells us that Zion goes all the way from the city of David all the way up to the summit. And the summit is not only where he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkotim, but it's also where he met with Abraham, affirming that he would do those very things.
Yeah, you couldn't script this.
No, it's just absolutely amazing. So I'm finding myself now, I've spent a considerable amount of time translating the end of the beginning and the end of the book of 2 Samuel, because it talks about all this stuff and where these locations are. And I went through the first reference to where Zion is. Because I really want to track this down. I said, it's obvious to me what he's talking about, but let's prove it, because what I think is obvious and what Yahweh says might be different. And so I went through the whole thing. So just in the preface that co-locates Zion with the city of David, and now we're going to find that Zion is also co-located with the Temple Mount and also co-located with the summit of Mount Moriah. It goes up that whole ridgeline there from south to north. That just in the description of the people choosing Dode, Yahweh saying, Dode, I want you to be a shepherd to my people. And the conversation that they have leading up to the capture of Jerusalem from the Jabusi, there were 18 lessons, 18 insights that, you know, you just look at the words and say, oh, wow, that's extremely, you know, I was only doing it to affirm that this is where Zion really is, that Zion's not a separate mountain. And just in the first second, you know, I ended up writing pages with 18 different insights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, the whole thing is really marvelous. So, anyway, I had a very good time doing that. That's my favorite current insight. Now, I want to go back and we'll just go back a couple of verses to pick up where we were in Mizmor Psalm 91. This is going to be interesting, too, as we move into the second chapter of Yeshayah and cover Zion, because Dode wrote these words, benefited from these words, and then had a senior moment and made a decision that cost 70,000 people their lives because he forgot about these words. It says, because you, Yahweh, have invoked certainty, appointing and placing by invitation, making available, this is from Kara and Sim, the sheltered sanctuary of the Almighty. It's your place to dwell together. That's the nice thing about the relationship with Yahweh. My friend today called and says, you know, I finally get it. I've literally incorporated all of this. Is that once you come to that point, you have absolute certainty.
Mm-hmm.
No faith, no belief.
No doubt.
Yeah. The only place where we have questions at this point are in issues that are just fun. Like, is there an independent Zion? Or does Zion represent the signposts along the way? And are there three signs posted along the ridgeline that is Mount Moriah that collectively represent Zion? Well, that's a question. Found the answer. But, you know, those kind of questions we have. Who Yahweh is, what he's like, what he wants, what he's offering, what he expects, what he's promised. No faith required. No belief required.
Fair
questions. Very clear. And you just incorporate it as part of your nature and you don't worry about it. One of the things that's really nice about it too, mm-hmm. is that while we can veer from our responsibilities and cause our current relationship to be less productive than it ought to be. Dode made that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that. But there is no sin that we can commit that will cause Yahweh to renege on his promises. His promises are unconditional. So, you know, I have a friend that writes me, wants to know, you know, does, if I do this, is that sin? You know, what I don't want to be sinning. And I keep saying, why do you care? You know, unless it's causing your relationship
to astray.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the only two things. Is it causing someone else to go astray? Because you're really a rotten example? Or is it so diminishing the quality of your relationship with Yahweh that you are not productive? And if you're worried about, is God going to view that as sin? You are hurting your relationship. He's a liberator. He's releasing us from it. He sees us as lily white, as perfect, as white as light. And so, you know, that's one of the things you come to realize in this relationship is that it really does, in terms of the ultimate outcome, what we do once we're part of the covenant family no longer matters. It only influences the quality and the productivity of our relationship with Yahweh in the here and now as to whether or not it benefits others and whether or not it's as joyous as it ought to be. Are you really learning things and having fun with it? And it could potentially influence whether or not someone else finds them. You know, if we weren't about this together, less people would know Yahweh. If, you know, Larry is going to join us this evening, if there wasn't Larry involved, if Scott hadn't become part of the family and said, you know, I'm enjoying this, even though it's no longer part of my job, I'll freely give my time to be a part of this because I want to be, because I enjoy it, fewer people would be part of Yahweh's family. So, you know, we are engaged in what he wants to accomplish, His promises are absolutely unconditional. And they're even unconditional when we don't engage in his what he wants done. It's just that at that point, you know, we're not helping anybody else.
That's a fair analysis.
So anyway, he's provided this place for us to live together. He says, you will witness. Now, if you are engaged in Yahweh's business, if you're doing something he wants done, he says, you will witness no harm or distress, and no assault, no strike, no blow, no beating, no wound, no trauma shall befall you, nor actually come near your home or household.
Boy, what a promise.
What a promise. Yeah. What? Well, I had a good friend, another one of our good friends that lives down under, this one in New Zealand, wrote me. He says, you know, I've got a son that's part of the covenant, a son that's, you know, not has not walked away from Babylon at this point. But he says, you know, and I catch a lot of grief for exposing the criminal syndicate that is Islam and for sharing Yahweh's testimony.
Yes.
He says, it's my understanding in Yahweh's nature that obviously my son, this part of the covenant, is protected by Psalm 91. But he says, I think that reading it, that even my son and, you know, and other members of my extended family who are not covenant members are protected. And that's exactly what it says.
Through their lifetime, certainly.
Yeah, it says right here that nothing's going to come near my home or household. It didn't say caveat. No one's going to come and harm you. Those members of your family who have accepted the covenant and who are engaged in the mission along with you, does it? Doesn't call.
No, it doesn't say that at all.
No, just says nothing's going to come to your home or household.
Yeah, blanket statement.
Blanket statement, which is what, by the way, what I specifically asked for. You know, it's interesting. If you negotiate with Yahweh and you ask for what he already has promised to give, you have a really high likelihood of him giving it to you.
That's a prayer you could pray.
Yeah, so here I said, you know, I'll go do this, but you've got to protect my home and family.
It's probably a very quick.
You would look at your partner.
It's probably a very quick negotiation. Yeah, sure, I'll do that, whatever.
He said, hey, pal, 3,000 years ago, put that in writing.
I wrote your answer.
Yeah, it's right. You'll find it in your right pants pocket. It's right there. I wrote the answer 3,000 years ago. So, yeah, you can have that one. But that one, by the way, is a big deal because, you know, it's one thing for us to go out and expose ourselves to harm.
Certainly.
And by the way, you know, it's really not all that harmful. What's somebody going to do to you? But it's one thing to expose ourselves. Another thing to go out and expose our family. And so, yeah, saying if you go out, I'm going to take care of your family. Now, this was really interesting. It says, and this is because his spiritual envoys and agents, his malach, will instruct and direct you concerning, concerning your approach to actually keep watch over you and genuinely guard you in all of your ways. One of the advantages of having a family is that by having other brothers and sisters who know Yahweh, collectively we learn more than any of us would come to know individually.
Sure.
We have a really smart friend that is a member of the covenant, that is a scientist that lives in the Land of Oz in Australia. And he is he's kind of at the raw end of his health. He's just come out of the hospital, and so it's we are all hoping that he stays with us a good while longer. But I want to tell you, he's already given us a lot. I was translating this section of Samuel, about Dode and what Yahweh had to say with him, and talked about Dode's walk with Yahweh and how it grew greater and greater. And Yahweh signed off by saying that this is because of Yahweh, the God of the Saba, which is typically translated the heavenly host. And I was wondering, you know, I must have translated Saba as spiritual implements, heavenly envoys, you know, a command and control regime of messengers.
Yes.
I mean, I bet I have translated that 500 times. And every time I do it, I'm always a little bit bothered by it. I said, you know, he's God after all. Something that he created is so insignificant to him being God. Why does he continue to say that he is the God of the Sabbath? Does it ever bother you that he said, or am I the only person who was bothered by that?
No, it's an awkward thing to say for some reason.
Yeah, okay. Well, Roy answered the conundrum. You know, we know that Yah was seven-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
We know that a seven-dimensional being cannot enter a 3, 4, 5, or 6 dimensional universe. Just as, you know, Walt Disney can create Mickey Mouse, but
you just can't get in there.
But he can't go into Mickey Mouse's world.
No.
Impossible. He can use implements to interact with Mickey Mouse, like a pencil, like a brush and some pigment, and he can interact with Mickey Mouse using those implements. But he can't himself go into Mickey Mouse's world. What are the Malak? What are the Saba?
Well, they are the light that can go in there.
They're implements.
Mm-hmm.
They're tools. They're implements.
Tools,
they're the brushes.
They're the
pigments. They're the pencil. They are the pigments. They are the implements. And so what, since a seven-dimensional construct cannot enter, cannot engage in and go into a lesser dimensional universe, whether it's 6 dimensions or 3.5 dimensions or 4, Yahweh can't do it. But he can sure as heck dispatch his implements and have them do it, just as Walt Disney can use his brush, his eraser, and his pencil to draw the next scene and to write the next dialogue box.
Right.
Absolutely. And so the Shaba, he constantly refers to the Shaba because the Shaba is his way of interacting with us.
Mm-hmm.
It's, he's got his.
So he says it for our clarity, right?
He's saying it for our clarity so that when we talk about he is Yahweh, okay, great. That's terrific. But he says, of the Saba, because it's the Saba that can enter our six-dimensional universe and interact with us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because they are at least six-dimensional, maybe even seven-dimensional for all we know, but they can't really be seven-dimensional. They're six-dimensional. But
okay.
But because they are an energy-based form, and they are less dimensions than Yahweh, he can dispatch them. They are fully developed in the dimension of time. So if we're 3.5 dimensions because we're stuck in the ordinary flow of time, and they are energy-based, light-based, they are at least fully four-dimensional. And so we can't fully appreciate them.
Yeah. And that conforms to every scientific anything. I mean,
yep.
They can do that. Light can penetrate all these dimensions. So
yep.
That's not an odd thing to
say. Yeah. But it's for darn sure we can, that Yahweh uses them to interact with us. And since that is the implement that he uses, that's why he says it's Yahweh host. What he's saying here.
He's reassuring us, we just didn't get it right away.
Right, right. You know, Yahweh didn't say, I myself are going to intervene on your behalf.
Mm-hmm.
Because guess what?
We can't do it. There's some limitations
that we've talked
about many times.
This limitation is the best of all limitations. Why? Because he's going to make us like him.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go from 3.5 dimensions to 4, infinite in time, to 5, to 6, and to 7. Each time it's an infinite increase in capability and power. And so the very fact that he is 7-dimensional and we're 3.5, and that he's going to make us in his image, that's what he's promising. That's the good news, because we're going to be empowered and enriched and enlightened beyond our wildest imagination. So this is a good thing. But Yao is telling us that, you know, at 7 dimensions, the entirety of you cannot go into a 6, 5, or 4 dimensional realm. And so he uses his Malak, his spiritual envoys, and the Saba are comprised of Malak. He uses them for this specific purpose. And so that's the aspect of Yahweh, the tool of Yahweh that is being dispatched for our protection. But, you know, it's just the people that are religious, they thank God for everything that happens to them, you know, for their victory in the last election cycle, for their base hit, that won the game for the good score on their test for winning the lottery for, you know, all manner of.
You don't care.
Yeah, he didn't have any involvement with that.
No.
None. And, you know, he will, when absolutely required, for those that he cares about, for the mission that he wants accomplished, he will let his Moloch, with very specific directions from him, do what he wants done. And
well,
it's
I find it interesting, you know, when we talk of the end times and the Muslim invasion of Israel, that he sets it right, and then he says, now I'm going back. You know, and I'm going to spend time with my family.
That's right.
Contrary to a Christian approach, it would be
But that's really funny.
Wow.
That's exactly what he says. There's a subtlety there, but it's true. It's you know, we're here until right after Israel is offended at the waist, until the world, with the United States leading the charge, forces Israel to forfeit the West Bank, thinning Israel to 10 miles wide, where 70% of the people live. This is going to have the same effect that giving the high ground of Czechoslovakia to Adolf Hitler had is going to lead directly to World War III. And immediately thereafter, you know, between the start of the war, I mean, it's that phase of the war, because the Magog War is already being fought. It's being fought in Syria.
And God's finale.
Right. And God's very clear about how it's going to start in Syria. Syria is going to fall. Damascus is going to be a heap of ruins. By the way, I saw pictures the other day of homes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's people that shot video of homes. Talk about a twisted heap of ruins.
Yeah.
There's nothing there. I mean, it's uninhabitable. There's literally nothing there. This was a city of 2 million people.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing there. It's just nothing but a twisted heap of ruins. So anyway, you're correct. After God then takes his covenant family out before the invasion of Israel, he says, I'm out of here. I'm going to spend time with my family. I've done what I'm going to do. And, you know, he's going to use his Moloch to eliminate the invaders when they enter Israel. He will absolutely...
Don't take that side.
Don't take that
Walk
side.
Walk away.
Yeah, it's a really dumb side to take. So not only is Yahweh saying, I'm going to protect your home by way of the Moloch, he is also saying that he's going to protect us in all of our travels. In all of our ways, no matter, you know, this word, Derek, in all of our ways, it's Bachol Derek, in all of your ways, in all of your travels, in all of your ways.
Yes, everything.
What that means, it's not just everything that we do. It means, you know, I've got a lot of ways that aren't exactly Torah shining.
Yeah.
Perfection is not
not a concept with me.
No. And so, you know, and why I spend of my 6 days a week, I spend the preponderance of my day having fun doing these translations and writing this. Spend a lot of time at it, have a lot of fun at it. You know, there's things I do that are less productive. And so what this is saying is that no matter what we're doing, the promise of protection, no matter where we are, no matter what we're doing, the promise of protection is valid. That was the point I was trying to make when Dode really screwed up. Dode sends a bunch of his men to kill a bunch of people and risk their lives because he wanted a cup of water from a spring in Bethlehem.
Yeah.
And when they get him the cup of water, he spills it out on the ground.
Yeah.
And then he goes and he decides that he's going for 9 months. He's going to count the number of troops he has at his disposal. Now Yahweh asked him to shepherd his sheep.
Mm-hmm.
Now shepherding your sheep is taking them to water, not having them risk their lives to get you a cup of water.
Right.
Shepherding your sheep is you protecting them, not counting how many of them you have to
protect you.
Protecting you.
Right.
Right. And so yeah, he really got it back asswards. And so he's, you know, he's feeling pretty darn bad about this. And my point was then Yahweh's prophet, a prophet named Gad. You know, for all those people that say that you can't say God, God's the name of a pagan god, and you can't use the term God. Well, Yahweh had a prophet named GD. So, I don't think
you're going to take that.
So take that, those of you who say that God is based on Gad, and Gad is the name of a pagan god, so you can't say God. Well, I beg to differ. Yahweh had a prophet named GD. So anyway, and at this point, Dod and Yahweh weren't talking. Dod had a mission. Dod decided that his own little thing was more important than the mission he'd been given. And so Gad was told, okay, there has to be a consequence for this. And I'm gonna have you give Dod three options. He can choose any one of the three options. One option is that that there be a famine for 7 years in Israel. Well, that's a really lousy option, right? But what are shepherds supposed to feed the sheep, right? Be a 7 years famine in Israel because this shepherd didn't do his job. The second is that option is that your foes, which would be the Philistines, for 3 months pursue you personally. So for 3 months, you have to flee the pursuing presence of the Philistines for 3 months personally. Option three is there'll be a three-day pestilence, a plague, that will infect Israel. Now, if you had written the 91st Psalm and knew that God's protection of you was universal, if you had survived 10 years of King Saul trying to hunt you down and kill you, and you realize you were the one that screwed up, that were using the troops to protect you as opposed to you protecting them, who had used people to take you to a cup of water rather than leading them to water, wouldn't you choose option two? And to say, you know, let them chase me for 3 months. Nobody else is bothered. They chase me around here and there for 3 months, and then we're all good again. He didn't. He said, you know, anything but the hand of my of humans. I don't want to be in the subject to humans. But he didn't listen to God. That wasn't God. Didn't say he was going to be captured.
No,
God didn't say he was going to be tortured. God didn't say he was going to be killed. Right.
They're
going to pursue you personally for 3 months. They didn't say, you know, that during that 3 months they're going to stop pursuing you because they're going to capture you. No, they're going to pursue you for 3 months. Really? But he, just like Charlie, didn't listen. Didn't listen to the instruction, and he chose that one, and 70,000 Israelites lost their lives, which is probably at the time one out of a little less than 1%. Consequence, the shepherd supposed to protect the sheep, failed. And that's actually what leads then to the establishment of the temple on Moriah, which is part of Zion. But Dod didn't pay any attention to this, that God's going to protect us in all of our ways. It doesn't matter what we do, his protection, his pledge of protection is without reservation.
Do you understand where that puts us in relationship? I mean, this guy knew him. I mean, this was Yah's favorite, and he had so much knowledge of everything. And where we are now that we can talk about this and know and instantly know 91st Psalm and what option it should have been or what. What a
absolutely
time to be in.
Yeah, but and I agree with that. But also keep in mind that that Yahweh used Dod as the example.
Oh, yeah.
Because Dod is viewed as righteous with God. Dod is the most loved human that ever lived with God.
Oh, yeah.
That doesn't mean that God loved everything that Dod did.
No, of course not.
But what it means is that the Torah exists to vindicate us no matter how many things we do
really screw
in opposition to Yah's guidance. You know,
we obviously learned from all his mistakes.
Right.
I mean,
Doubt is the perfect antidote to Pauline Christianity. If anybody who is a Christian would compare what Paul wrote about the Torah, that it was impotent, that it was that it could not save.
Yeah.
And then you look at Doubt, because in his claim is, if you violate any one of the laws, you're guilty of all of them.
Yeah, stupid.
Doubt is exactly the opposite of that. He violated all of them. Not all of them, but he violated bunches of them.
Well, he gave it a good shot.
Yeah. And Yahweh said he's righteous. He's upright.
Yeah.
He's vindicated.
Shaddock.
He is Shaddock, man. And that was the very thing that that Paul wrote that the Torah could not do.
Well, he did a pretty good job with Doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. So, upon the open palm of their hands, I want them to actually and continually lift you up, preventing you from stumbling by striking your foot or stance, even your journey of exploration against a stone. It's regal, which is your footsteps or your walk. Regal, your examination and investigation to gain information so as to teach others to walk would be regal, perfect word. And agap, from tripping up. You know how easy it is to trip up when you're trying to expose and condemn? One of the two most revered characters in all of history?
Well, it should be pretty easy. I think what you've written is at the heart of it is you certainly don't get tripped up much.
No, but, you know, it was... You're talking about a book in the Quran that is absolutely incoherent.
Yeah.
It is it's a jumbled mess without context or chronology.
Yeah.
And it is constantly creating errant portrayals of other historical figures. And it's errant scientifically, it's errant historically, it's errant prophetically. And without any context or chronology, it is the most jumbled, insane mess ever attributed to God. And so you're trying to, okay, I need now to show why this book ought not be trusted and ought to be rejected and ought to be exposed and condemned. You know, good luck with that.
Yeah, without reorganizing it, yeah.
Right, and there's only one way to resolve that, which is to reorganize it chronologically and set it into the context of Muhammad's life. And fortunately, there are two collections of oral reports from Muhammad and his companions written within 200 years of Muhammad's death that enable us to do that. But without that very systematic and logical approach to this whole thing, there was no way. It would have been impossible. And so the very method that was deployed kept me from tripping up. I never had to interject my own opinion. I never subjected myself to any potential tripping, you know, by me extrapolating interpreting and therefore being made vulnerable to being tripped up by some kind of a scholar or theologian or expert.
Yeah, you because, hung him on his own words.
Absolutely. Hung him on his own words.
Same
indeed.
With Paul.
Absolutely. Exactly
Paul
the same.
Paul his own sword. Anything we do. Just tell him what he said.
Tell him what he said. Compare what he said to what God said. And that's all you need to do. And so that is the way that I was kept from tripping up. And also during, 3,000 radio interviews, exactly the same process occurred. Was precluded from tripping up by having the benefit of these malach.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely it is.
Yeah. So that's what he says is available to you. Then it goes on to say, so you will set out to take aim against the horned viper and venomous snake who twists and perverts, the tethin, and the dragon, to aggressively stomp upon the creeping nature of the fierce lion and the horned and venomous serpent. You know, at the time that I was requested to engage in this battle, this mission to expose and condemn Islam. I did not know that Allah was Satan. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the time that I had read the Quran through once from beginning to end and found out that Allah only is mentioned in hell and that Allah is demonic in his nature in hell, torturing, very, very specific and graphic tortures of people, and that Allah is 100% opposed to free will, and that Allah is fearsome and a terrorist, and that Allah is demeaning of women, and that Allah admits that he's a liar in the Quran. Second surah, I mean, 106 verse, second surah. When we have a contradiction throughout the previous statements that are contradictory, and we toss them into oblivion so that you go with the last one. Well, you know, a contradiction is the absolute sure sign that you're lying. And so you look at all of those characteristics, it was obvious Allah was modeled after Satan. Allah is Satan.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that at the time that I started, but it became obvious thereafter. The mission was to stomp on the creeping nature of the venomous serpent known as Satan. And when, you know, later when the mission was to expose and condemn Paul, both men, by their own admission, were demon-possessed. Both men were controlled by Satan. Their message was very similar because they're...
Why doesn't that freak people out?
Yeah, you know, the most amazing thing is...
Why doesn't that freak you out?
Yeah, but Muhammad twice said that he was demon-possessed. He told his wife he was demon-possessed. He explains, his first encounter with the representative of Allah is exactly like Paul's experience on the road to Damascus. They were both beaten silly. They were both blinded. They were both taken to, it's the exact opposite of experience with God. God calls the lame to walk, the blind to see. Well, both of those guys, with their experience with Satan or his representative, one in a cave, one on the road in the wilderness, on the road to Damascus, both of them had such a horrific experience, they were debilitated by it. And Muhammad admitted to his wife, and it's recorded for our benefit, says, I've been demon-possessed. That's what happened. I was demon-possessed. This was a demon that I was wrestling with. And every aspect of the Pauline experience is exactly the same. It was a demon.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul, just like Muhammad, ends his diatribe with his farewell sermon, and he says that a jinn has been permanently attached to me. And he says, oh, but the jinn wasn't there. Jinn is a demon, satanic representative. That the jinn wasn't there for bad, but for good. So what does Paul write in his last letter to the Corinthians?
He can make him on the right path.
Yeah, he says, you know, the thorn in my side is a messenger from Satan.
Yeah,
but not for not no not for bad, but for
path.
Yeah, but for good to keep my ego in check.
God,
you know, how could there be a religion of 2.3 billion people today when the founder of that goddamn religion admits that he was demon possessed? I mean, how in the world could that even be possible? To me, it's completely and utterly astounding. But here, anyway, what we have is Yahweh telling us that the mission that we are accepting is going to take aim directly against Satan. So, you know, Satan is presented as the Pithon. The perverse and poisonous snake, the devious asp, the deviant cobra, the one who deviates from the standard by twisting it. You know, how does a snake travel?
Serpentine.
Right. In fact, the word serpentine, it describes a serpent, which is another word for snake, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And how does Paul corrupt the God's message?
Right. He's crooked as a snake, isn't
he? Right. He twists it. How did Muhammad make the Quran seem religious?
He twisted the writing from the Talmud.
That is exactly right.
and all they the
twist.
Stories from the
they
story.
Twist. Christianity is a twisted variation of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But just as if you were to use your artistic capability to create a $100 bill,
mm-hmm.
no matter how close your $100 bill was to the truth, to the real McCoy, it's not only worthless, it's a liability. And so, anyway, he says this is the one you're going to take aim at is the one who twists and perverts. It is the snake. That is the metaphor for Satan, the dragon. This is he uses two different terms here. One is the pethen, which is the horned viper, the venomous, because it's poisonous serpent who twists and perverts. And the second is the dragon. And he uses right. this that reference, by the way, also in Revelation. But this is in Psalm 91. The dragon is Wa-tanim. It's the serpent of the sea. And since the dragon is a serpent of the sea represent what group of people?
Well, that would be the goyim.
Yeah, absolutely, the Gentiles.
Always.
Yeah, the Gentile political and religious establishment. And so it is it's the religious establishment of the sea, the dangerous creature that had become the beast, if you will, of the Gentiles. You know, God goes through the five Gentile beasts. It, you know, goes from Babylon is the first of these vicious beasts to Persia to the Greek beast that was Alexander the Great to the Roman Empire beast to the Roman Catholic Church beast. Satan is a five-headed monster. This is the five-headed monster that is Satan. That's the dragon of Satan's influence on the Gentile religious and political establishments.
You know, I found a bunch of things that I thought were relevant, especially to the end times or the mm-hmm. the Magog War. The initial one, of course, is dragon and sea monster and so forth, and coming out of the land, I got the same things
mm-hmm.
that you did. But there's also an older version where it's also a crocodile, and I
right.
from the sea and from the rivers, and that would be a pretty good analogy of the Egyptian Muslims
correct.
Coming up
correct.
That way.
Right. But also, but the crocodile, is the Egyptian gods
mm-hmm.
also back in the day.
Right.
One of the most revered of the Egyptian gods with the crocodile.
Sure.
And they viewed the Nile as being godly, divine, and the beast of the Nile was a god. So this beast is the Egyptian religion, but you're right, the crocodile also represents the rise of vicious Muslims
yeah.
against Israel.
And then I went to Tan, the root, and it's a jackal. And when you think about what does a jackal do, he's really, he eats others kill.
Right, he does.
He eats carrion and so forth. So it's,
yeah.
Got it, ain't nothing good in this stuff.
No,
but
and
I mean,
then.
It's very picturesque. It tells you exactly who he's talking about, certainly in this.
Right, and the other one, so we're going to stomp on these creeping creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the fierce lion, and it's Kefir, the aggressive adolescent lion, from either Kafar, the ultimate cover up. The one who whitewashes and tries to appease, or Kofar, which is a money-making scheme that includes bribes or ransoms, where a price is paid to live for one's life.
Who's really good at ransoming? Enslaving people for ransom.
Right, yeah, and who's really good at whitewashing?
Yeah, well, we are.
Yeah, religious individuals. That's the whole concept of all of this. So the pethon, the horned viper and venomous serpent who swits and perverts, is the most common metaphor for Satan throughout the Torah and prophets. But tanim is also prevalent as the dragon or serpent of the sea because it's symbolic of the way that the devil influences Gentile religious and political schemes, which are born and bred in Babel to fool the unsuspecting. So we've got these three different metaphors of Satan, and by the way, one of those metaphors is the symbol of Babylon, the winged lion.
Yes.
So God is really quite clear as to who we're going to be warring
that's
against.
Babylon.